It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a hot, humid day here in Washington. Lots going on. We're going to talk through a number of legislative issues here in our hour, and we're going to start. We've spent a couple of segments over the last few weeks talking about the transportation bill that President Obama recently signed into law and looking at some of the major changes in it. We're going to do that again today with one of my favorite colleagues from Patton Boggs, Daryl Nuremberg. Daryl is the co-chairman of the lobbying group at Patton Boggs and an expert on Senate legislative and parliamentary procedures, having served as both a chief of staff for a United States senator and in a senior leadership position for a major committee there on the Hill. And Daryl, we're here to talk to you today. There's always cats and dogs in any major bill. Transportation bill had funny things like a student loan extension on it. But one of the unique things about a transportation bill is you have to pay for those roads and those buses, and you have some strange things in there. I want to talk to you a little bit about this situation involving the roll-your-own cigarettes industry. I know it's been reported that basically in that bill, President Obama, with a single swipe of a pen, eliminated that industry. But give us some of the details of that story and whether or not it's true.
Well, thank you, Kevin, and thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having me on the show. And this report or story has received a great deal of currency. It was carried by NPR and then picked up from there, the idea that with a stroke of a pen, an industry was eliminated. But as with anything else in Washington, there's a lot more to the story. Specifically, what was going on here and what Congress sought to end was a practice of evading federal law with respect to the manufacture of roll-your-own cigarettes. Specifically, Kevin, in 2009 and 2010, Congress passed three laws, the intent of which was to address tobacco use. Congress increased the excise tax on cigarettes and roll-your-own tobacco, established registration requirements, and imposed FDA regulations. Cigarette tobacco, cigarettes, and roll-your-own tobacco, the tobacco people buy in bags, take home, and roll at home into cigarettes, were covered by all three of these acts. Pipe tobacco only saw its tax increase slightly and was not covered by the registration or regulatory statutes. Manufacturers, seeing an opportunity here, some manufacturers, started taking their cigarette tobacco and RYO tobacco bags and changing the label to sell it as pipe tobacco, thereby self-excluding themselves and their product from these laws. The next step in the process is certain entrepreneurs started developing and then selling machines which could be placed in tobacco stores where consumers could buy loose pipe tobacco, which was really roll-your-own tobacco, pour it in the machine, hit a button, and then get a carton of cigarettes 8 minutes later for roughly 40% of the price of a legitimate cigarette.
Sounds like an interesting loophole in the law.
Yes, we saw it not so much as a loophole, but as evasion, because the law is very clear that this product should be taxed, regulated, and registered as if it were roll-your-own or cigarette tobacco. In fact, the Tobacco Tax Agency, Taxing Bureau over at Treasury, agreed, and about 2 years ago issued an opinion stating that these machines violate current law unless they are registered as manufacturers. That action was subsequently held up in the courts due to a procedural motion or procedural issue. Thus, the machines kept on running, stores started springing up with these machines, and Congress was compelled to act.
Well, tell me a little bit about who supported this provision, because obviously there are people who are pushing for it in order to get it in this bill.
There are really three different groups that were supporting it. There was significant support on the Hill, because tax policymakers saw this activity as clear evasion. In addition, fixing this clear evasion would raise revenues, which could be used in the transportation bill, as you had mentioned in your introduction. Second, on the outside, the largest supporter of this legislation were the convenience stores. because convenience stores, knowing that the Treasury had sought to bring these machines under regulation, were reticent of adopting the machines for fear, justifiably so, that they would be violating the law and would owe back taxes. That did not stop certain tobacco stores from acquiring machines and competing directly with convenience stores with the capability of selling cartons of cigarettes for 40% of what convenience stores were paying or selling it for. So convenience stores were losing businesses for doing what was right and were pushing it. In the background, the major tobacco companies wanted to see this fixed because legitimate companies that sell properly taxed, regulated cigarettes were being undercut by this evasion. So those were really the three groups behind the legislation.
Well, so you mentioned at the top the sort of NPR creating this perception that the industry is wiped out at the stroke of the pen. And so I don't recall seeing any articles saying that since this bill has been signed into law 3 weeks ago that stores have shut down. So is that actually happening?
Yes and no, Kevin. Stores which were built solely to house these machines and take advantage of the evasion scheme largely have shuttered or suspended their operations. Stores which had these machines and had other tobacco-related businesses, which were open and profitable prior to this evasion scheme, remain open. We have become aware in the last few days that there are some stores which have machines and continue to run them, attempting to continue to evade the law through such tactics as putting the machines in a separate location. Our analysis, however, of the congressional law and of tax code is that is not permissible, and we expect that at some point the tax agencies will come down on those stores.
Yeah, interesting. So what's this all mean if I'm not a smoker, Daryl, so I'm trying to understand the impact if I'm a consumer and I've transitioned to this product because of the tax evasion that you mentioned. What does this change mean for me now?
Well, consumers who were buying product produced by these machines will see their costs increase because they will be left to have to buy legitimate cigarettes. It's very similar to any time a trafficking scheme is ended. Those people who benefited from the trafficking no longer do. But again, Kevin, it was the intent of Congress, whether we agree with it or not, to change how cigarettes are sold in this country, to tax them heavier and to regulate them. And with this new law, people who were avoiding that will just have to comply with the law.
Interesting. Well, you know, what's fascinating to me is I didn't really stop to think about all the different types of labeling of tobacco, and that something could be pipe tobacco compared to sort of cigarette tobacco. What are the legal implications of selling cigarette tobacco in packaging that's been labeled and taxed as something else like pipe tobacco?
That's a good question, and it's fairly relevant because when you count up, Kevin, all of the cigarettes that are being manufactured, whether in a store prior to the enactment of the transportation bill or at people's homes, that comes out to about 7% of the market for cigarettes, which means that if it were just one company trafficking in mislabeled product, it would be the fourth largest cigarette company in the United States. So it is a very widespread problem. It violates three laws. Federal excise tax, which there's a significant differential between how we tax pipe tobacco, legitimate pipe tobacco, and roll your own or cigarettes. The FDA regulatory regime, which was established in the Tobacco Control Act, which requires the FDA to regulate tobacco and or cigarettes and its manufacture. This mislabeled product fits squarely in the definition of cigarette tobacco and roll your own tobacco for that purpose. And last but not least, Congress also enacted what's called as a PACT Act, P-A-C-T Act, which was designed to assure, designed to prevent cigarette trafficking by assuring that manufacturers properly register and report their sales of cigarettes and RYO tobacco, and also bars the sale effectively of these products over the Internet. The mislabeled product is not complying with that act either. So you have three federal bills, acts that are being violated by this practice.
So do you think that getting this in the bill is going to ultimately stop the sale of cigarette tobacco in these things that are labeled as pipe tobacco?
good question. That is a question that is being looked at on the Hill presently. We know it's being looked at in the states. And the bottom line is it appears that by eliminating machines, it'll address part of the problem. But as long as manufacturers can take what is essentially roll-your-own tobacco, put it in bags, and mislabel it as pipe tobacco to avoid federal regulations and obtain lower tax, the problem will continue. So I fully expect, Kevin, that we'll see more attention on this issue, both in the congressional and in the regulatory arenas in the coming months.
And Daryl, real fast, got about 90 seconds left. Give me a sense of why something like this gets done in a transportation bill. You know, that doesn't necessarily make sense to the average person on the street.
Well, that's a good question, Kevin, and I think you addressed it and summed it up very well in your introduction, which is Congress has certain budget rules which either require in fact or in practice that spending programs be offset with savings in federal spending or in additional revenues. And traditionally, the tax writing committees, Ways and Means Committee, Finance Committee, and the Joint Tax Committee, which works as our analyst, will have a list of, quote, revenue raisers, which are loophole closers, legislation to stop evasion. And this was one of those provisions where revenues could be raised by helping to assure that people comply with the law as previously written.
All right, well, we're going to wrap it up there. We're going to hit commercial, come back and talk about the status of health care reform in Congress. Back with more Capital Thinking in just a moment.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we continue our discussions this summer since the Supreme Court ruling to talk about the implications of that ruling, what it means for businesses as the Affordable Care Act continues its implementation timeline. Joining us, Julie Black, a policy specialist at Patton Boggs and one of the authors of the Capital Thinking Healthcare webpage that we keep there. Julie is always on the show to talk about these issues. And Julie, want to get caught up on where things stand with Medicaid expansion. I know the Supreme Court did uphold the Affordable Care Act. We spent that whole hour the day the Supreme Court ruled on the show talking about it and what it meant. And that decision made the Medicaid expansion optional for states. So tell us a little bit about what's happened since the decision, what the implications are for individual states.
Sure. Well, I know you spoke with a number of my colleagues about the implications broadly for the Affordable Care Act and the ruling that the Supreme Court issued last month. But in terms of the Medicaid expansion, the decision really does wreak havoc on the Medicaid expansion, and it means that a number of individuals will likely remain uninsured despite the intentions of the Affordable Care Act to increase coverage for Americans. In fact, a number of states, because of this decision, will have to weigh difficult political, fiscal, and policy considerations as to whether the Medicaid expansion is even a viable option to pursue. And this is despite the fact that the ACA provides an enormous amount of funding to states to really push them to do this. At present, it's unclear whether the administration will offer additional incentives beyond what was outlined in the ACA to help give states who are either on the fence, who are leaning toward not expanding coverage, to moving forward with a Medicaid expansion. One thing to note, I know we'll spend a lot of time talking about state implications today, but, you know, providers really won't be impacted by the state's decisions as well. Certain payment reductions were made with the assumption that there would be a decrease in the number of uninsured. And now the reality is that providers may continue to bear the burden of uncompensated care for those individuals who do not have access to expanded Medicaid coverage or who will be ineligible for coverage through the exchange. And it's interesting, today we actually learned that at least one lawmaker, Congressman Jerry Connolly of Virginia, is considering introducing some legislation that would offset the cost to providers. So I think we'll still continue to see some fallout and people react to the decision.
Well, so, yeah, let's talk about that. If you had to put a guess down right now or forecast this, how many states you think choose to expand their Medicaid program and how many use the Supreme Court decision as a way to opt out?
Well, we are actively tracking what governors and state insurance commissioners are saying about the decision and what criteria they're going to use to make their decision. So at present, there are five governors who have declared that their states will not participate in the Medicaid expansion. And those states are Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Texas. There are another six states who are leaning toward not participating, but who have not made a definitive decision. Another nine states plan to participate, and there are three states who are on the fence but who are likely to go ahead and implement a Medicaid expansion. All the other governors appear to be undecided, and it's interesting because the decisions that have been made really fall along political lines. So Republican governors are saying they don't want to have anything to do with this. This is an encroachment upon states' rights and independence. But we expect that many governors will actually wait until after the November elections to announce their decisions. And quite frankly, you know, we see a lot of states waiting for additional federal guidance. Some questions remain in terms of whether states will be required to opt in or opt out. And there are some questions about how all this interacts with the exchanges and how the federal government will provide premium assistance tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies to individuals who are eligible to purchase through exchanges. And HHS has indicated that they will issue this guidance. They've just not indicated when, so everyone is waiting for that.
Now, Julie, in the run-up to the Supreme Court decision, after the oral arguments, conventional wisdom in Washington shifted to the perception that the Supreme Court was likely to overturn at least the mandate and perhaps the whole thing. And in many ways, Republicans bought into that conventional wisdom. I know I did, like many Americans. and they didn't really have a well thought out strategy, or it doesn't appear they did, to deal with what actually happened, which is the law is still in place, and they still want to repeal, but they haven't spent much time on replace. So what is their legislative strategy here for the second half of 2012?
Right. I think, you know, there was a little bit of surprise by the decision from both sides of the aisle, stakeholders, providers. And so I think there is a little bit of rejiggering. The other difficulty is that in an election year, we see that not a lot of legislation is moving. Again, we still have a Democratic president in office and a Democratic Senate. So the House Republicans are really up against a wall and have been more or less taking political votes on these issues than advancing real policy changes. But most recently, in early July, they passed the repeal of Obamacare Act. And interestingly, five Democrats joined in supporting that bill, which would repeal all of ACA, as well as the health care provisions included in the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act that is basically folded together to create the entire health care reform law. So again, we have opposition by the president and some Senate Democrats to the repeal legislation. But the other hurdle that was thrown to House Republicans this week is that the Congressional Budget Office issued an analysis of that repeal legislation that found that it would actually increase the federal deficit by $109 billion over a 10-year period.
So it actually costs money to repeal Obamacare. What do you think that obviously poses a number of obstacles then for Republicans in the legislative choices they make to roll back Obamacare?
Exactly, because this is, you know, something that they've also harped on in terms of priority being budget deficit reduction. So it really puts them in a difficult place. You know, I don't think they will take any more votes on repeal. You know, we've heard previously this talk of repeal and replace. To date, what we've seen is sort of piecemeal health care reform legislation introduced. So, for instance, a number of bills have been introduced to implement market-based insurance reforms that would expand coverage more incrementally. Republicans have also supported tort reform, reforming Medicaid so that states receive block grants and they have the ability to do with the funds what they think is appropriate for their population. And then also there's been a push to establish a premium support model for Medicare. Congressman Burgess of Texas, who's actually a physician, has signaled that he plans to introduce replace legislation before August. But again, we really don't expect anything to advance prior to the November elections and may not advance in the lame duck section either, depending on who's elected.
Interesting. Well, let me shift a little bit. Let's get into some of these state-specific issues. Let me take you to Maine, where the governor and attorney general have basically taken that Supreme Court ruling to mean that the state doesn't need a waiver from the federal government to enact Medicaid cuts. My sense is that Secretary Sebelius, President Obama, have a different opinion of that. So talk us through the court's decision and how it affects Medicaid provisions that are outside the expansion we've been talking about so far.
Sure. So just to provide a little bit of color, the governor of Maine, based upon his interpretation of the Supreme Court ruling, does plan to submit a state plan amendment that would cut 38,000 people from the state's Medicaid program. And he's taken issue with a provision that's called the maintenance of effort requirement. And that provision requires states to maintain their eligibility levels based upon the date of enactment of health care reform for Medicaid until the Secretary of HHS deems that the new state-based health insurance exchanges are fully operational, which we don't expect to happen until 2014. The provision also requires that states maintain their eligibility levels for children in Medicaid and CHIP through September 30th, 2019. Sorry, I was just going to talk about basically in response to all of this, there have been a couple analyses that have been issued. One, the Congressional Budget Office issued an analysis this week about the decision. The Congressional Research Service and then the Secretary of HHS has also sent a letter to the governors And essentially, they all agreed that the maintenance of effort requirement was not directly affected by the court's decision, and it remains intact. So we don't expect his state plan amendment to receive approval by CMS. Nonetheless, he may, again, continue to take issue with it. There's one other provision related to Medicaid that has been challenged by some governors, and that's the modified adjusted gross income eligibility standard, which this is a new standard to basically make consistent eligibility for a number of programs. And again, the Secretary, CRS, and CBO have said that this eligibility standard was not directly affected by the decision.
Gotcha. Well, so talk to me. So the maintenance of effort requirements, you think they are still in effect?
Yes. I think there's been positive indications that the maintenance of effort requirement and the MAGI standard are in effect. We've seen nothing to suggest otherwise. And although we are still waiting on formal guidance from the Secretary, you know, she did issue a letter to the governors saying that the court's decision did not affect any other provision of the law. She also interestingly mentioned that states will continue to have flexibility to design their Medicaid benefits package and that the administration will exercise its authority to establish a hardship exemption for certain low-income individuals in states that don't expand Medicaid.
Well, let's take a break here. We're going to come back with Julie Black and more conversation about the Affordable Care Act right after this commercial.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, we are talking with Julie Black from Patton Boggs' Healthcare Policy Group and one of the co-authors of the Capital Thinking Healthcare webpage that you can find at capitalthinkinghealthcare.com if you want the latest and greatest on what's going on. We were talking a lot about Medicaid expansion. And now I want to talk a little bit about Health and Human Services in general and ask you about Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. What sort of formal guidance, now that we've gotten past the Supreme Court decision, is she giving to states about expansion of Medicaid?
Sure. I mean, state governors as well as the Medicaid directors in each state have outlined a number of questions for the secretary. And I think maybe they were caught off guard as well and didn't anticipate such a decision from the Supreme Court. So we've not seen formal guidance at this point, although she's issued a couple letters in response to these requests for information, although they've been very general. One letter indicated that states will not have a deadline by which they need to make a decision about the expansion. And another has indicated that the federal government will actually provide funding for health information technology enhancements to states, regardless of whether they choose to expand Medicaid. HHS staff has indicated that guidance is forthcoming, although we don't have a sense of the timing. HHS is hosting a series of regional forums, implementation forums, beginning in August, the first one being August 14th in D.C., and we're hopeful that the secretary may provide additional insights about the mechanics of the optional Medicaid expansion, but we'll have to see. Certainly additional guidance is necessary.
Well, let's transition to talk a little bit about health benefit exchanges. I know a lot of what's in the Affordable Care Act, really the bill on that comes due in 2014, and nowhere is that bigger than with the exchanges. It seems to me like you have a whole range of responses to the exchange, some that got at it from the moment. Some states started the moment the bill passed. Some basically waited around, waiting to see what the Supreme Court would do. So talk to us about what states are doing now to get their implementation timeline back on track.
Sure, and this is very similar to what states are doing with the optional Medicaid expansion in that only 15 states to date have authorized establishment legislation or issued executive orders to establish an exchange. And there are three others that have indicated they intend to move forward with implementation. I think that many states were probably holding off on implementing the exchanges just to wait for the Supreme Court decision to avoid the unnecessary use of resources if this thing was going to fall off the books. A number of states, though, and you can imagine that their Republican governors have indicated that they are not going to establish a state-based exchange. The federal government has indicated for those states that don't operate an exchange themselves, the federal government will come in and operate what they're calling a federally facilitated exchange. So sort of an interesting dynamic with Republican governors messaging that they want control of their Medicaid program and how it's operated, but yet are willing to have the federal government come in and operate a exchange for them.
Well, I know one of the things you spend a lot of time on, Julie, is basically tracking, analyzing, and influencing all the regulations that come out of the Affordable Care Act. There's a tremendous number of them, with each with their own implementation timeline. So talk to us about what's come through this summer, what's still to come on tap in the near future from HHS.
Well, just to give you a snapshot about the regulations impacting establishments of exchanges, between HHS and the Internal Revenue Service, there have been nearly a dozen regulations and guidances that have been issued, and those relate in part to the exchange development themselves, but also to what's called essential health benefits, which are the required benefits that plans offered through the exchange must cover for beneficiaries. The other related guidances and regulations relate to the premium tax credits and the cost-sharing subsidies that are provided to individuals with certain income levels to help them pay for their insurance and pay for the health care provided through the exchange. So at the moment, everyone is on the edge of their seats waiting for a regulation that provides additional clarity about the essential health benefits and what more specifically is required of plans to offer through their plans, through the exchange. And I think we expect in July or into fall that this regulation will be released.
Gotcha. Well, I want to go back to Congress for just a minute, Julie. I know the House, since they legislatively can't dismantle Obamacare through a series of authorizing legislation, they're doing some things in the appropriations process, especially this year in the Labor HHS appropriations bill, that has some of the same effect. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. So the action on that is in the House. They recently had a Labor HHS subcommittee markup, and that bill would actually rescind most of the funding to implement the health care reform law. And in a surprise move, it actually eliminated two agencies that are devoted to studying healthcare effectiveness. And the bill also prohibits all economic research at the National Institutes of Health. The bill narrowly passed out of subcommittee. In fact, the subcommittee chairman needed to wait for one of his Republican colleagues to return to Washington from caring for a family member who was recovering from an injury to ensure that he had the votes he needed to move that out of the subcommittee. You know, the outlook for that is pretty dire. They have not scheduled a committee markup, and I think that we're looking at a CR, either 6 months or perhaps longer, that follows more along the lines of the Senate funding levels. So the House Republicans, though, have certainly been heard loud and clear, and they've outraged actually a number of stakeholders, particularly those involved in healthcare research.
Well, you talked about the spending side. So let's go back to the revenue side for a minute. One of the more popular items that the House did manage to do that undermines the Affordable Care Act is pass something repealing the medical device tax. Explain to everyone what that provision in the Affordable Care Act does and what its chances of maybe getting across the finish line before the end of the year might be in Congress.
Sure. So this was a piece of legislation that was introduced by Congressman Eric Paulson of Minnesota, where there's a great presence of medical device manufacturers. And this provision in the ACA would put a tax on medical device manufacturers. This was, as you alluded to, a pay-for provision in the health care reform bill. There have been a number of hearings on this. There was a markup earlier this year that was very contentious. The bill does have bipartisan support, however, and was passed in the House earlier this year with bipartisan support. The prospects are a little bit unclear. I think we'll have to wait and see what the election holds. There are some Senate Democrats who support the legislation. I don't think Senate Leader Harry Reid is willing to bring this up before the August recess and before the election either. We'll see. I mean, time is of the essence. The medical device tax goes into effect in 2013. The IRS had issued earlier this year a proposed rule detailing how that tax would be implemented, and we're awaiting a final rule, hopefully in the fall, to be issued. But again, there's a lot of groundswell for this, a lot of support for repeal of that tax.
Yeah, it does seem like it's one provision that has strong bipartisan support in both chambers, so I think it might have a decent chance of getting included in some sort of year-end tax package. You mentioned Senator Reid. You mentioned, alluded to the campaigns. So I guess I want to shift from policy to politics for a minute and ask for your opinion about how big an issue the Affordable Care Act will be on the campaign trail for Congress and the White House this fall.
Well, I think it's interesting because the latest polling shows that 67% of likely voters find health care being very important. And that's right behind the economy at 74%. So while people are out of jobs, again, we sort of can't get away from the health care issue inside the Beltway, but apparently it is resonating outside the Beltway. And I think it's telling that actually in the Supreme Court decision, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that essentially, you know, they are not there to make policy judgments. They really are counting on the American public to make those decisions, and if they don't like the policies that the elected officials make, then they need to throw them out of the office. So I think in terms of healthcare reform, the one big challenge that remains are the November 6th elections. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Interesting. Well, Julie, in the short time I got available, do you have any closing thoughts on where the Affordable Care Act stands in the implementation world?
You know, in terms of the implementation, it is really full speed ahead, particularly at the agency and department levels. We are seeing new initiatives, new regulations being rolled out every day. And quite frankly, you know, that'll come to a screeching halt depending on the November elections if candidate Mitt Romney is elected, who intends to repeal all of Obamacare and set forth his own free market and fair competition reforms. So I think it'll be full speed ahead until we see what happens with the election. And if President Obama is reelected, I can't imagine that we'll slow down at all, particularly as we look to 2014 and major, major reforms.
That's right. I think Republican opposition in Congress knows that after 2014 comes and goes, whatever hasn't been repealed becomes extraordinarily difficult to repeal because it'll be embedded into the business operations and the government culture. Well, Julie Black from Patton Boggs joining us. If you want more of Julie's thoughts and analysis and that of her colleagues on what's going on in healthcare implementation, I encourage you to go to the webpage that we have, capitalthinkinghealthcare.com. You can read all about a variety of topics related to the Affordable Care Act there. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, one of the things we love to do on this show is to highlight some charitable entities that are doing great work with their mission. We're delighted to have on the show today some folks from Running Start. That's an organization that aims to help increase the involvement of young women in politics and get more females running for elected office. Joining us, Amy Smith. Amy Smith is a policy advisor, works with me at Patton Boggs, and basically provides guidance and advocates on behalf of a number of not-for-profit entities around the United States. And also from Running Start, we're pleased to have Susanna Schakow. She's the chairwoman of the board for Running Start. And in the last decade, she's founded two organizations that help raise the political voice of young women here in America. Running Start looks like it was founded just about 5 years ago. And then Susanna has brought with her Casey Duggan, who is a rising third-year student at the University of Virginia in their leadership school there and is a member of Running Start. So, Amy, why don't you get us started, no pun intended, by telling us how you got involved with Running Start.
Absolutely. Well, I was fortunate enough to have a strong female role model earlier in my career who also happened to be a member of Congress. However, as Susanna and Casey and many others well know, that women typically need that influence much earlier in life and much more frequently to consider running for office and getting involved in elected office. So Running Start has programs that start with young girls and carry them throughout their young adult lives. I know that Susanna and Casey will talk more about that, but I actually found out about them shortly after they were founded in 2007. I think I went to an event in 2008 and was just so impressed with the mission and their vision. They have grown so much in that short amount of time. I am honored to be an inaugural member of Running Start as well as an advisory council member for them. I've volunteered at their Young Women's Political Leadership Program for the past 4 years or so. Truly am enamored with this program, moved by its participants each year. We've also at Patton Boggs hosted a couple of Path to Politics lunches for them. Have had a partner here, Rosemary Becky, be involved in that effort as well. We hope to host more in the future. I will let Susanna speak a little bit more about the organization and its commitment to inspiring these future young women leaders, but I just wanted to say how pleased I am to be involved with the organization and to have found them.
Well, thanks, Amy, and I just want to say that small organizations like Running Start, I mean, we rely so heavily on volunteers, so it's people like you being involved that really keeps us going. So just to tell you briefly the history of Running Start and what our mission is we realized that I founded the organization back in 2007, as Kevin said, and we realized early on that women don't see themselves as candidates nearly as much as men do. And when you poll women and ask them why they don't want to run for office, they often say, well, you know, I think women should run, but I don't know, I don't have what it takes to run. I'm not qualified enough to run. I don't have the skills to run. And Running Start is really based on this idea that if we start earlier in women's lives, if we start, you know, as young as high school, changing that attitude, empowering women to know that they do have the skills, that there's no magic formula to run for office, that anybody can do it, and demystifying politics a little bit, you know, to show them how to do it, that we will get more women running, and we'll get them running at a younger age.
Interesting. Well, I know one of the things that you're very proud of is you recently received a grant from Walmart, one of the great grassroots supporters amongst corporations here in the United States. Tell us a little bit about your engagement with Walmart and also some of the programs that funding is going for.
Sure. Yeah, we were very lucky to get a grant from Walmart right in the very beginning of our programs. We started out just teaching high school girls, and our program really emphasized three things. We introduced high school girls to political role models, usually young political role models from both parties. We talked to them about the need for more women in politics, and then probably the key thing we do is we teach them leadership skills, so we help them feel confident in themselves as leaders. And after doing that program for 2 years, Walmart came to us and they said, listen, we think you should be working with college students as well, and we're going to give you a grant to bring college students to D.C. to learn what it's like to be involved in politics and to start the path of running for office. And so we've this is the renewal of our grant. We got the grant for the first time in 2009. And I think it's just, if I was a college student, I would do this program in a second, because it takes juniors and seniors and recent grads in college, brings them to D.C., we give them housing and a stipend, and we give them a job working for a female member of Congress. And then once a week, we take a day off and give them seminars on the leadership skills that we teach in our other programs, and introduce them to great contacts who can help them in their political careers.
Well, that's a great transition to the actual college student that you have here with us. Casey, tell us a little bit about your experience in Running Start as an undergraduate at UVA.
Great. I actually participated in the Young Women's Political Leadership Program the summer following my senior year of high school. I actually heard about the program from one of the tech support people that was working at my high school at the time, and ended up applying and going through that program, and it was fabulous. We, like Susanna was saying, we went through different seminars about networking, public speaking, campaigning, fundraising, and on-camera media training. And I just had the most incredible time and met the most incredible young women and successful women in D.C. And I actually ended up coming back this summer and interning and actually kind of doing the behind-the-scenes work with the program, which I've had, again, the greatest time with, and I've been working with other interns as well, and doing kind of the behind-the-scenes work has made me appreciate the program that much more.
Well, Casey, let me stick with you. What do you think your generation can do to contribute to getting more female involvement in the policy and political arena?
I think just kind of looking at it, I mean, even my mother's generation just had just a completely different mindset. Within our generation, I think it's just become so much more common for us to have goals of becoming CEOs and politicians and taking on those leadership roles that weren't necessarily kind of widespread in past generations. And I think just having that mindset along with the tools that we have today will take us light years ahead in terms of political involvement and not only just becoming politically active in terms of voting and stuff, but taking on those leadership roles and starting at a young age and becoming interested in running for politics.
Well, Susanna, let me come back to you, because Casey sort of references progress. Tell us how the United States compares in terms of female candidates, female engagement in the election, and why you think that females will be so important in the 2012 election.
Well, you know, I speak to a lot of groups both here and overseas, and I think that one thing that is often surprising to especially American audiences is how low the U.S. falls in terms of the percentage of women we have in our legislature. The statistics vary between being 76th in the world and 90th in the world. So we're far behind most other countries in terms of getting women into politics. And I think that's a surprising fact. Most Americans think we're number one in everything. And in terms of women's role in the 2012 election, the women, first of all, we vote more than men, which is also perhaps a surprising statistic. But we vote more than men, and this election looks like it's really going to be determined by women in a lot of ways. And you can see both Obama and Romney really starting to court the women's vote. I have read recent articles, though, saying that Obama is polling far ahead of Romney in terms of the women's vote. And, you know, women, we have a slight edge on men population-wise, and there's no denying that the women's vote is something that you absolutely you cannot ignore if you want to win.
Interesting, yeah. That polling I've seen shows a real dichotomy between young single females and married females in terms of some of their perceptions about their party affiliation and their candidates of choice. Susanna, in the time I have available, talk to us about the future, where Running Start's going, and how you can get involved to be a volunteer or to be a supporter?
Sure. To be a volunteer, go to our website, which is runningstartonline.org. We're always looking for good people. We have three programs around the country. Most of the stuff we do is in D.C., bringing people from around the country here. But we have an L.A., a Michigan, and a New York program. And the future of Running Start is to bring the program to many more cities around the country, because there is definitely the need. We have many more people wanting to be a part of our programs than we can possibly bring in. So
we'll wrap it up there, and we'll see you next week for more Capital Thinking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.